A very busy program on Thursday, October the 29th on Connecticut Today in the 3 o'clock hour. Professor John Ellis talked about his new book, in which, after years of teaching at universities all over the world, he cites a disturbing trend, he says, of universities not so much teaching as indoctrinating students, especially politically. We carried a portion of Governor Ned Lamont's briefing, the latest one on the coronavirus situation, in the 4 o'clock hour, with the state's positivity rate inching back up over 6%. And also in the 4 o'clock hour, a computer sciences and cybersecurity authority from Quinnipiac University on a threat by ransomware hackers that may affect the medical records of you and I. Evan in Shelton. Evan, hi, you're on WICC. What's up?
Hey, how are you? I heard you talking good. About the Philadelphia shooting. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're loud and clear. Go ahead. Yep.
All right. Thanks. So you were talking about tasers. Tasers only work if the person's not high on drugs. If they're using a PCP drug or if their adrenaline is so high, they're not feeling any pain, that's what happens. And when you're tensed up like that and you're, you know, you're out of your mind, so to speak, you're really not going to be paying attention to pain. It's just like when you have a lot of adrenaline running through you and then something happens, you get into an accident, something happens, you only find out later on that you're hurt. Right.
Well, you're right. Tasers aren't perfect. I mean, we have this image of I'll just tase him and they just drop to the ground. Evan, I mean, how many times have we seen the image of, you know, somebody being tased, whether it's in the news, right, or on one of these cop shows, and the cops still have to fight with them? I mean, sometimes, you know, like I said, these suspects, like you told me, sometimes it doesn't work. You're right.
No, exactly. And should they have him? Absolutely. Because there's a what's called the force continuum. You know, first you talk. That's your first step. Yeah. Then you might use the mace, you know. Then you might have to go to a baton. Then you might have to go to the taser and so forth and so forth. And all these situations change. You might not have time to talk. You might have to go up higher on the force continuum. You never know. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that not everything is cut and dry.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was brought up, I believe, were mental health issues.
Yeah.
Okay. So when the police officer has a reasonable suspicion that the person is mentally ill and, you know, they're out of control, well, they get cuffed and they get brought down to the police. I'm sorry, not the police department, the hospital.
Sure.
The officer fills out a form in triplicate detailing why this person needs to be evaluated. It's called a psych eval.
Okay.
And if the hospital talks to them and they say, you know, are you going to hurt yourself? No. Are you going to hurt somebody else? No. Well, that's about all they can do for them. And then they get released after, I think it's a 24-hour mandate. And they're back on the street. So the mental health issue is huge. All right. In my last 2 years, I worked a lot of overtime.
Okay.
And I started seeing the same pattern, a lot of mental health problems, a lot of mental health issues.
Evan, let me ask you something. Hold on. Before you go on, I'm going to let you go on. But before you go on, so if that person you guys bring in, obviously you're in law enforcement, I get it. If you bring that person in and the psychiatrist on duty is talking to this person that you just brought in, and if they act calm and say, you know, I'm not going to hurt myself. I'm sorry what I did, or, you know, whatever. So can the family then... can you talk to the family or the family? Can they talk to the officers? What is it if the family says, no, this is not the first time this has happened. He's done this before. I'm afraid he's going to hurt himself or someone. How does that work? Is there a process for that?
And you would talk to the family, because usually that's what happens. You end up talking to the family, you know, what's going on. This was a disturbance. One of the things that when the police officer gets there, he talks to everybody. If the person's out of control, you have to control them first. But you're going to talk to the family. You're going to say, what's going on? Oh, he does this all the time. He hasn't taken his medication. He's been off his medication for a long time. He refuses to take it. And if they can't force him to go, then you're going to put all this in your report. Yeah. And then it's up to the family also to talk to the doctor, to go down there and see what can be done as a follow-up. We can only do so much. We're not social services. We're trying to protect this person from themselves and from society, from him. there's just a limited amount that the police officer can do. And what I described, the procedures and all that, that's, you know, at least in Connecticut, that's what's done.
And look, I can imagine, you touched on this, Evan, you know, a lot of people tend to, you know, armchair quarterback this stuff. Well, what they should have done this and they should have done that. And maybe, and you and your fellow officers and even the officers all around the country, listen, mistakes happen. I understand it. But you're dealing with people here. And I think most people realize this, Evan, you're dealing with people here that, you know, can come on you with a knife or whatever this suspect had, you know, in a split second. And I don't think, Evan, people really understand still how quickly officers have to make a decision.
There's actually, when I went to the academy, we learned as part of our training that there's what's called the 21-foot rule. Hmm. So if you're standing there with your gun holstered, okay, you know, and you're trying to talk to somebody, and someone's standing 21 feet, that's a quite a distance.
Yeah.
21 feet away from you, and they have a knife, and they decide, I'm going to charge this officer, I'm going to charge at him, and I'm going to cut him. Yeah. Well, you have about a second or two to respond before you can get your gun out, if you're lucky to get your gun out, because that's how fast the little amount of time it takes to get to someone standing that far away. You should try it. You know, people listening.
It's not a long way. It's 20 feet. It's the length of maybe three grown men, maybe 18, 20 feet. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, wow. Yeah, you do have to respond. I mean, listen, the last thing that anybody wants to do is shoot somebody. I'm telling you, it's not fun. It's not fun for anybody. It's not fun for the family, not for the person to get shot, and especially not fun for the officer. I almost shot a 15-year-old kid one time, okay? Mm-hmm. Almost shot him. I was almost in the process of pulling the trigger because he had a gun on him. It was a fake gun. Oh. And thank God I didn't. And that was like 20 years ago. To this day, I don't know if you can hear my voice, but I still get emotional about it.
No, that's all right.
I had a nightmare because I almost shot this person. So just imagine, you know, actually shooting someone. Nobody wants to shoot anybody.
And Evan, it's not unusual, as you probably know from being in law enforcement, it's not unusual to hear police officers who never, right, who say they've been on a force for years and they never discharge their weapon in the line of duty, right?
Nope, I haven't.
Wow.
I mean, I almost did, but thank God just the circumstances worked out where I didn't have to. So,
Evan, thank you, my friend. I really appreciate it. Good luck still. Be careful out there. And thank you for the input and the unsolicited, opinion you gave here, which is from somebody, a man or woman who does this every day. I really appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Just one more thing.
Sure.
Mental health. We got to push mental health. Mm. The states shut down all the hospitals. It's mental health is what's going to help. That's the bottom line. Thanks for talking to me.
Mm-hmm. All right, Evan, thank you. I do appreciate it, my friend. Thanks. Evan, they're obviously a police officer. And thank you, Evan, once again for, you know, your perspective on this. There are people who would say, like Evan said, that, you know, there needs to be more affordable inpatient care for people who may have been, and again, I'm not completely familiar with this gentleman's condition in Philadelphia. His family says it was a long-running thing with him. Well, then, you know, should we provide, well, not should we, we must provide either low-cost or no-cost care for people who maybe should not be, doesn't matter what color, what creed, suburban, rural, man, woman, what condition some people should be given better care. Being our first guest of the afternoon, he's a distinguished professor emeritus of German literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's taught at schools and universities in Wales, England, and Canada before joining UCSC in 1966. He served as the dean of the graduate division there from 77 to 86. Numerous books, the new one, The Breakdown of Higher Education, How It Happened, The Damage It Does, and what can be done. John Ellis is the guest. John, hi. Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
John, thank you so much for being on. I saw the pitch for this book, and I said, amen, hallelujah. I'm going to have you on because this, John, is one of those things that just frosts me off when I see and hear what is happening at some of these colleges and universities, not only here in America, but around the world. And you're calling it the breakdown of higher education, John. What exactly is breaking down in the thread of our colleges and universities?
Well, I think the rock bottom of it is this, that about 50 years ago, the predominant type of person teaching in universities was an academic scholar. And an academic teacher's job was to promote independent thinking. In other words, not telling you what to think, but expanding your own capacity as a student to think independently, to analyze problems, to see all sides of a problem, you know, to be able to look at the strengths and weaknesses of ideas, compare them to other ideas. And an academic teacher of that kind only wants to expand the thinking power of his students. Now, today, that type is now in the minority on campuses. The majority type now is the political activist. And the political activist is the opposite kind of person. The political activist doesn't want independent thinking. He wants you to think the way he thinks. So he doesn't want you to be opening up your mind to new ideas and looking at the strengths and weaknesses of ideas. He doesn't want you to think about it that way at all. He wants you to believe what he wants you to believe. That's it. Now, you can see these are two completely different types. One opens up your mind, the other shuts it down. And it's a dreadful thing when higher education, which is supposed to promote independent thinking, in fact shuts down independent thinking. It's the exact opposite. Mm. Instead of giving you something that's useful to you, it takes away your ability to think for yourself.
And the classic theory of the liberal arts professor and or education at a college, as you say, is to entertain thought no matter how distasteful it might be to you, and to, you know, kind of probe you a little bit to say, well, wait a minute, why does that person think that? Let me see if I can get deeper into this, rather than shutting it off, having to go to some, yeah, you know, safe space. I mean, it's really frightening to me.
It is fine. No, you've got it exactly right. I mean, that sort of curiosity, the intellectual curiosity. I wonder how this thing works. Let me understand this thing more deeply. Let me go into these sets of ideas, in detail and see how they work. All that is absolutely the opposite of what political zealots want you to do. What political zealots want you to do is take the ideas they give you, believe them, never doubt them, never give any quarter to anybody else who has different ideas, try and shut them down as well. The result is that's not an education. It's the opposite of an education. You know, it's actually, it's not just simply that they don't do a good job of educating you. What they do is the opposite. They shut down your mind. It's a shocking thing that people pay large amounts of money for tuition. Parents send their kids to college. And, you know, it sometimes seems to me it's like the Stepford Wives, you know. the Stepford Wives were, you know, people who were real people, real, you know, real minds, real opinions, real lives. And along comes someone and substitutes a robot. It looks like what it used to be, but it isn't. It doesn't have a mind. And this university world is the Stepford Wife of academic life. I mean, the buildings are still the same, you know, magnificent old buildings. The titles of people, professor of this, professor of that, still the same. They get a bachelor's degree, looks still the same, but it's totally different. It's nothing to do with what it used to be. It's a kind of a Stepford Wife. They substituted something that is totally alien to what it really should be.
And one of the questions is, how was this allowed to happen? We'll get to that momentarily. The guest is John Ellis, noted professor. He's taught in several universities around the world. His new book, The Breakdown of Higher Education, How It Happened, The Damage It Does, and What Can Be Done. John Ellis, hang on. We'll be right back to you. Traffic and Weather Together, 336 on WICC. And a lot of us, your humble host here included, did pay or are paying, either by cash or by loans, thousands of dollars to educate our kids, our grandkids now in many universities that really, according to some of the reports you read and some of the guests I have on the show, are becoming more indoctrination centers than centers of critical thinking. Our guest, John Ellis, noted college professor all over the world, his new book, The Breakdown of Higher Education, How It Happened, The Damage It Does, and What Can Be Done. So, John, your first question or first posit, how it happened here, I look at that and I say, well, did it happen intentionally, John, or unintentionally?
Oh, intentionally. There's no doubt about that. Back in the 60s, a group of radicals, about 200 of them, called the Students for a Democratic Society, met at a conference, and they lamented the fact that they got nowhere at the ballot box. They knew that they could not possibly win by the normal process of election. So they decided the way forward for them was to take over the universities. Now, I was there at the time. I was teaching in American universities. Not quite in America yet, but I was in a British university. But I remember reading about this and thinking, this is a joke. 200, you know, malcontent kids who know nothing, thinking of taking over the universities. But it took them 50 years, but they did it. And I think what you should never underestimate is the persistence of Marxist radicals. They never go away. They never stop trying. They seize every opportunity they have. And if they don't have opportunities, they manage to make some. And I've got to hand it to them. They have performed wonders, but they did have some help. And the one really huge help they had was this, that the Second World War, you know, had soldiers going off to the war and interrupting their family life. So they came back in 1945 at the end of the Second World War, and they started their family life again, which meant a huge boom in births. It's called the baby boomers. So 1945 to 1950, unusually high number of births, which means that 20 years later, that generation is ready for college. So between 1965 and 1975, the number of students in higher education, in public higher education, went from just under 4 million to just over 8 million. So in other words, more than double. So in other words, what you have between 1965 and 1975, you have a tremendous need to hire new professors. In fact, you have to hire more new professors than the sum total of all of the existing ones in 1965. Now, that's breakneck speed. You've got to suddenly double the size of a profession almost overnight. And it so happened that 1965 to 1975 was noted for something else. It was the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So at that time, the campus was roiled by dissent over the war. The young people felt that their government was pursuing an unnecessary and brutal war that had no sensible rationale. That's what they thought anyway. And the result is that political radicalism on campus got a tremendous boost. I mean, the membership of the Students for Democratic Society went from 200 to, maybe 100 times that, very, very quickly. And so all those new professors that were being hired between 1965 and 1975 because of the baby boom, they were being chosen from graduate students on campuses that were roiled in an unusual way by political radicalism. So there was a sudden influx into the profession of a whole lot of young radical leftists.
And that started the whole wheel turning then to where we are today. Professor, we're a little short on time. I want to ask you this, pick your brain on this. I'm sure you may agree. This frightens me for one other big reason, is that you have a lot of folks in college now who are being coddled, who have these safe spaces, who protest and commit vandalism when speakers are on campus they don't like. How does this set them up to survive in the real world, where you may have to encounter bosses and clients and coworkers? Where are their people skills coming from?
Well, like I was saying, this is not an education; it's an anti-education. You know, they're being trained in how to behave like children, where education should be preparing them for adult life. It's encouraging them to keep it immature, to stay immature, stay childish, because, as you say, they're unable to deal with opinions that differ from theirs. They pout like children. They scream and shout like children. This is how bad education, higher education is. And the sooner the public realizes that it's not just wasting money on higher education, getting nothing for it, it's worse than getting nothing. A whole generation of young adults are being taught to behave like children, are being pushed backwards in maturity, not forwards. It's a shocking situation. I hope the general public of this country wakes up to this and stops sending its kid to colleges that do this, because it damages our culture.
You're right. You're spot on, Professor. As I tell young kids, only half kiddingly, go become a plumber, go become an electrician, and go to night school. You know, this
well,
way,
see,
you're not paying back the loans. I am.
That's right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Look, I mean, plumbers have to deal with real problems. Plumbing is not all plain sailing by the book. Sometimes a plumber finds a situation in a house that. He has to rack his brain and be really inventive and ingenious to solve it. That's expanding your mental capacity. That's a lot more than higher education does right now, I'll tell you.
Yeah, The Breakdown of Higher Education is the book. The Breakdown of Higher Education, How It Happened, The Damage It Does, and What Can Be Done. Encounter Books is the publisher. The guest, John M. Ellis, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of German Literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Get the book wherever you get them, your local store or Amazon and all that. Professor Ellis, thank you so much. It's been fascinating. We appreciate the time, sir. Good luck.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate it. All right, folks, there you go. The Breakdown of Higher Education. He's talking about what do we talk about on this show all the time? The radicals have taken over the colleges, and now you have to set up safe spaces. If there's a unpopular speaker that has to, that speaks at UConn or at Fairfield or at Southern or at Quinnipiac or at UB, whatever, we have to make sure there are spaces for the kids to recover from what they heard. They need counseling now. I'm not kidding, folks. There are schools that when there's a conservative speaker on campus, they offer counseling because of some of the damaging things people have said. Oh, my God. I mean, take a look at what happened when our own Ben Shapiro, he appeared up at UConn about a year and a half, 2 years ago. You would have thought they were bringing in Chairman Mao. Although, a lot of UConn students probably would think, Chairman Mao, pretty cool guy.
COVID daily numbers, and I look hard to find a silver lining, and I can't find it in these numbers, except perhaps the fact that we have done a lot of testing, over 150,000. But what you ought to see is with 1,300 new positive tests, that's a 6.1% positivity rate. That's the highest rate we've had since June 1st. Couple that with hospitalizations continuing to creep up and fatalities. There's no good news in those numbers. And it reflects what's going on in our region. Despite the best efforts of the people of Connecticut, we are part of a region, and it reflects what's going on in the country, where they've had the highest infection rates so far throughout. That 6.1%, I usually can say, oh, don't worry, it's just a one-day number. Our 7-day rolling average is 3.1%. But let's face it, we've gone from 1 to 2 to 3, and this 6.1 may be a harbinger of things to come. And it's going to get worse before it gets better, but we're going to weather it together. Let me tell you what it looks like on your map. I said we're going to show you the COVID alert map on a weekly basis to give you an idea of what additional towns are in the red alert status, which we can conceive of as 15 new daily infections out of 100,000. And by the way, that does not include correctional facilities or nursing homes. These are things that are more indicative of community spread. And we've gone from 19 to 30 towns in that red alert status. Again, primarily there in Southeast Connecticut, if you can see in that map. And another 53 are in the orange category, which are, as we found out over the last week, often are moving towards red. So between the red, which represents about a third of our population, and the orange, which represents a little over a third of our population, I think you get an idea of what the trend lines are. I'll tell you what that means in a second. Let's take a look at the next chart. So what can we do? If you're in the red alert area, we have said you have the option of rolling back to phase two. And so far, there's been one of these towns has elected to take that option, and that's Wyndham. And one of the many reasons that, you know, we've got Jim Rivers here with us. We're going to allow anybody in the orange or the red towns to exercise the discretion to roll back to phase two. I think in terms of erring on the side of caution, allowing municipalities to do the right thing, just like what Wyndham has done, I think is important. Just as a reminder, we only moved to phase three less than a month ago. So if you roll back to phase two, what does that mean? That means not 75%, but 50% occupancy in your bars, not your bars, but in your restaurants or personal service, you know, nail salons, barbers, hair and the such. That would mean no more indoor performing centers. We had a partial opening there. A maximum of 25 people in gathering. We had up that in phase three, but that's what phase two would mean. These are all things which you can do as municipalities on your own. A, it sends a signal that we're taking this seriously, and we know that the COVID infection is ramping up, and it's ramping up not just by municipality, but in terms of Southeast Connecticut, some other regions, and you can be proactive there. And over the next few days, we'll see whether that's enough. We're also giving you flexibility in thinking about what we do with winter sports, to be blunt. You probably have heard me say that Massachusetts has closed hockey rinks or paused hockey rinks for 2 weeks. New Hampshire's done the same thing. They've done that because hockey or all the activities in and around hockey have created a lot of infections, well over 200 in Boston alone. We have about 45 hockey-related infections, and in part that's the first of the winter sports that's getting going. I'm not positive it's exclusive to hockey. Again, Paul and myself, I reached out to all of the governors in the region as we try and think about what we want to do together, what we want to do together in terms of phase two and restaurants, what we want to do together in terms of sports and winter sports. And my guidance to you would be, you know, be careful this weekend. Let's see if we can do this right. Obviously, some of the rinks have been very strict in their enforcement. Some have been more casual. Some of the restaurants have been very strict. The overwhelming majority of our restaurants have been very strict. Some have been casual. So we'll see whether enforcement is enough or whether we're going to have to, you know, be stricter, and we'll figure that out early next week, and in many cases working in collaboration with our regional states. I think you know what we've already done on nursing homes, but given what happened in our nursing homes back during the first wave of COVID, we are testing all staff on a weekly basis. Any residents on a more regular basis, if any cases, they'll be tested at least weekly. If there are any cases there, not allowing visitation. If there are no cases there, you could visit. I would strongly recommend that you be tested before you go visit a loved one in a nursing home. Again, in terms of other actions to slow the spread at this point, we're increasing the focus and targeting on high-risk activities and enforcement. You know, we have talked before about some of the bars masquerading as restaurants, and I got to say, you've been pretty strict. Our municipalities, working with the departments of public health, they shut down a number of these facilities. They can fine you $100 for not wearing a mask. They can fine you $250 for going to an unsanctioned party, the likes of which you maybe saw on our Twitter feed the other day, or fine you even more for organizing an event like that. I'm going to see what we can do a little bit longer by strict enforcement, allowing you that enforcement, giving you the tools we need to keep your community safe. And by the same token, consumer protection here at the state level, we're going to be looking at liquor licenses and see what flexibility we have there to, again, show that we're serious about enforcement. I'm doing everything I can to keep our economy going. I'm doing everything I can to you know, allow us to have some level of normalcy. And I'm trying my best to do this with enforcement and self-regulation, what you can do in terms of your sports, what you can do as municipalities, what you can do to roll back like they've done in Wyndham. And if that's not good enough, we find we've got a stretch going on next week, we'll take a look at putting in another level of strictness. Just tell you on the next chart, might as well tell you, as I look around the country, and more importantly, or just as importantly, as I look around the world, and I've described this before, what are other places doing? We described a week or so ago what we see in Europe. Europe is, say, 3 or 4 weeks ahead of us. They've been the canary in the coal mine. They are beginning to roll back. They are, you know, closing down pubs and cafes and restaurants, or at least closing them down at a certain hour, say 6 o'clock in the evening. They're being stricter in terms of stay safe, stay at home orders, if you remember that from some 6 months ago. And while they're being very strict there, they are continuing to keep their schools open. So I thought that was interesting. They're finding the same thing as we are, that in-classroom activity is a low infection area, at least to date. As I see here, we now have a dashboard we're putting up. You can see at the bottom in that really thin light blue, go to the data.ct.gov, COVID school. You can look up your school. You can see exactly what the infection protocols are there. Just very quickly, in the last week, we had another 123 staff cases. That's up 18 from a week before. That's out of, you know, tens of thousands of staff. Student cases, a total of 233 new cases reported. That's an increase of 3. So relatively flat compared to what you're seeing in the general population, certainly. In person, which is interesting, 76 infections related to what was transmitted in the school. That's down 5. So, and that's 76 compared to, say, 400,000 or 500,000 kids who are going to school in person, or at least had the option of going to school in person. Hybrid, about the same as last week. And fully remote, which is interesting. Many fewer kids going fully remote. Maybe it's 5-6% are fully remote in terms of schools that aren't open at all, but more not or telecommuting or distance learning. And there you're more likely to have, you know, some infections. I thought that was just an interesting slide, just in terms of as we think about sports, we think about restaurants, and we think about schools, where is the spread and what can we do about it on a voluntary basis, on a municipal basis, or even on a statewide basis and a regional basis. With that, look, I'm putting a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of our first selectmen and mayors and town managers. And Wyndham is a town that was in red alert status. Wyndham is a town that decided, is about the only town so far that has decided to roll back from phase three to phase two. I think you're going to hear Stamford and New Haven elect to do the same thing over the next day or two. And I got to tell you, don't think it's because Willimantic's not a fun town. In my experience, it's the funnest town in the state of Connecticut. If you ever been to Willie Brew, if you ever remember the Boombox Parade. But that said, they also know how to take COVID seriously.
Turn visit here on the show to talk about a warning. This is serious stuff now, folks. A warning that has come out from the feds a couple of days ago is Associate Teaching Professor of Cybersecurity at Quinnipiac University, Professor Fred Scholl. Fred, good to have you back. Paul at WICC, how are you?
Thanks, Paul. I'm good. How are you?
Good, Fred. Thanks for coming on short notice here. So this warning came out, on Wednesday here, I think, middle of the week. And I know what ransomware is. You know what ransomware is. But explain to my listeners who may not be on the cutting edge of this stuff, what is ransomware and what's the warning about here?
Yes, ransomware is a type of malware that gets onto or is sent to and is implanted in systems like hospital systems. And what it does is it encrypts the data, as you just talked about, electronic medical records and other data, so that they're not readable by humans. And the gig here is that the criminals offer to decrypt the data if you pay a ransom in Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency. And the warning was a couple of days ago. It was from Department of Homeland Security, Department of Health and Human Services, the FBI. It was basically a warning highlighting a credible threat against multiple hospitals. I think they said 400 hospitals. The credible threat being an attack by a ransomware gang.
So, Fred, you know, somebody may hear this who may have a little computer knowledge and say, well, wait a minute, guys, hold it. These hospitals, they're on the cutting edge of everything with all this machinery, all this imaging, different electronic surgery options. Can't they or shouldn't they be backing up this data in, you know, storage that is not internet accessible? Are some hospitals, Fred, doing that, or is it just something that's not done? Is it done on a scattershot basis? Talk about that.
I think it's done as a matter of course. It's hard to get it exactly right because hospitals have so much distributed data, and it's not all like in one hard drive like it is on yours or my laptop. So the question is it being backed up? It's really the execution. So in theory, they all know they should back up their data since ransomware hit, you know, a number of years ago. They know they should keep it offline. The question is it being done right? And then can they restore the data, you know, that they've backed up? Can they restore it in a timely way so that if they do get hit and you show up to check in, they can get the data? And what's really scary is that the ransomware guys, I think they're in like their third generation of ransomware. And the ransomware that's out there is very resistant to the kinds of defenses that, you know, people like large hospitals would be putting up. So it is pretty scary, I think.
Yeah, scary stuff. Fred, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Associate Teaching Professor of Cybersecurity, Professor Fred Scholl, Quinnipiac University, as if we don't have enough to worry about. Now we may go to the hospital, and the hospital may, 400 of them around the country, may not be able to get at our medical records if they are targeted by so-called ransomware. More on this straight ahead. Traffic and weather together coming up on 436 on WICC. A warning issued earlier this week from the Department of Homeland Security, the federal government saying, hey, some ne'er-do-wells with ransomware may lock up your medical records, medical directives, and things like that, where maybe, you know, this hasn't happened yet this time around, but there's a warning that maybe if you're in the hospital for COVID or something like that, the doctors, nurses may not be able to see your records. Associate Teaching Professor of Cybersecurity Fred Scholl from Quinnipiac with us for a few more minutes. Fred, this must be terrorizing to, or terrifying, I should say, to hospitals and the IT people in hospitals. You know, these hospitals probably pay hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to, you know, firms like Kaspersky and Norton and Trend Micro and all these Barracuda and all these big, you know, cybersecurity corporate level firms. And it still is a chess game, though, isn't it, between, you know, who stays ahead of who?
It is. And I think these firms have done a good job in, you know, sort of staying, I guess, up to, you know, the techniques used by the bad guys. But recently, within the past few months, some new strains of malware have been released. This Ryuk malware is one of them. And they've really gone beyond anything that people have seen before in terms of their level of expertise. So this stuff is really challenging to get rid of if it does get into your organization. And I'm sure that healthcare organizations out there are focusing on defense and being able to back up data. But I think one of their challenges is they have they have all this personal healthcare information and confidential information. And I think, you know, over the past many years, they've been focused on keeping that stuff confidential and making sure people get access to only what they need to get access to. So now they've got a whole new level of challenges that are being thrown at them. And the other thing that's worrisome to me is I think over the years, law enforcement's done an amazing job of catching these cyber criminals. In the ransomware game, they've been pretty elusive, and there have been almost no arrests. So these guys are kind of out in the wild sending this stuff from, you know, we don't know who's sponsoring it or who's behind it. But they haven't been stopped at this point.
I was just going to ask you, do we know whether these people, do we have any inkling, is this Russia, China, Eastern Europe, America, South Korea, North Korea? We don't have really any idea where this is coming from?
Yeah, I think they're all in this game. I think they're independent. You know, a lot of studies have shown there are criminal gangs out there. Some of them are independent. Some of them are state-sponsored. Some are out there to, you know, generate revenues for state coffers and stuff like that. So we don't know, at least I don't know the latest warning, you know, exactly which one of these gangs or state organizations was highlighted. But there are many people in this criminal endeavor right now.
What about, Fred, the practicality? Somebody may be listening to us and say, well, geez, why don't I just get a copy of my own data? Why can't I have it on a thumb drive? Or why don't these hospitals keep it on, you know, cloud servers? So if their systems get locked up, they could access it off of, you know, the Amazon backbone or somewhere. Is any of that considered to try and, you know, cope with this?
Yes, it's possible. So like Amazon and other cloud services, they have these deep archive services and you can store data. You can take it offline. But with those, there are restrictions in getting the data restored. You know, so it's very hard to have data that's not online and is readily restored. That's the challenge. So they should do that. And yes, I think people, you know, should be able to save their own data and encrypt it and kind of have it so they can take it as needed. That's a problem that goes beyond ransomware, right? To make sure you have control of your own healthcare data. So,
and again, you and I can talk about it, and we've restored data before, but it takes a heck of a lot slower than when a doctor wants to find out whether he can give you a certain medication. I mean, he or she needs that on a screen in front of them as you're laying in a bed and not looking good.
Yes, it's very, very hard, and you've got all the HIPAA privacy regulations, so you don't want to restore somebody else's data. So they've got, you know, just restoring the raw data is one thing, but getting the right data, the right people is, you know, an enormous challenge for these groups.
All right, good stuff.
Keep our fingers crossed. So.
Yeah. Fred, good heads up. I appreciate it. Associate teaching professor of cybersecurity, Fred Schall at Quinnipiac University, talking about a warning that came out from the feds about these probably offshore gangs that may be targeting, your health information for ransomware attacks. Fred, thank you. Good talking to you. We'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Yep. Take care.
Appreciate it. As if we don't have enough to worry about. Yeah, folks, this is called ransomware. And what happens is, and it doesn't only happen to hospitals, it happens to banks, insurance companies. It can happen to you. You can, if you click on something you think is an email and not, then all of a sudden you get a message, oh, hey, we locked up all your data, which is not good if you're a small business, your customer list, your customer records, your taxes. So be very, very careful what you do. But again, the scenario that we're looking at here is possibly, you know, the Fed saying that some of these gangs, and the thinking is most of them are foreign entities, you know, could target a hospital. And, you know, they could target a hospital that maybe you or I go to, or friends or relatives, and say, well, hey, you know, and some places do have to pay. You know, some places, whether they're hospitals or other entities, they do fork over, you know, money transfers to these gangs, these electronic thugs who are out there that tie up information to get it back. You know, other entities say, well, screw you. Guess what? We have copies of everything, and these copies are not attached to the internet. Well, go pound sand. Well, sometimes that makes these thugs and criminals, you know, even more resilient. They get angry at you, and they still come at you. So good stuff there.